Hello everyone, this is Charles de Battista. I'm head of 36 Stone, and thank you very much for making the time to follow this podcast, which has a particularly personal purpose, because it is about a book which I've authored for a number of years, but it's coming out in its new edition, its fourth edition, called De Battista on Bills of Lading in Commodity Trade. I have with me to chat a little bit about this book Francis Horniold Strickland, who's a colleague of mine, a member barrister in 36 Stone, practicing in this and in other fields. So we'll talk about his co-authorship, of course, during this podcast. But I'm particularly pleased to say that Diane Galloway has joined us for this podcast. Diane is a full-time arbitrator, particularly in the commodities area of disputes. This is after a long and stellar career in the city with a leading firm of solicitors with an enormous amount of experience in this field. And I think with those brief introductions done, both of the podcast and of the people you have on this podcast, I'll hand over to Diane.
Hi there. Hello to Charles and hello to Francis, and thank you for inviting me along. Talking about the book, the first issue, Charles, that you raised was the co-authorship with Francis. Tell me a bit about how that works and what difference it's made to the book.
Yes, well, let's start right at the end. The difference it's made to the book is that it's now out. in other words, the long interval between the last edition and this edition, which is about 12 years, would have been far, far longer had I not taken the plunge and decided to look for a co-author. And looking for a co-author wasn't that hard this time round, because A, it was just up the stairwell, which is in Chambers, which is where Francis lives. No, sorry, works.
sometimes both.
And also not far to look, because Francis and I have worked together professionally and actually written some pieces together. So we've worked together now for about a year and a half. Of course, COVID made life a little bit different, if not difficult. But perhaps that's all I want to say about how I sort of came across Francis as a co-author. Why don't I leave it to you, Francis, to say about how it worked, to say something about how it worked.
And you have to be honest here, Francis.
Well, I'm in the fortunate position of being able to be honest and being very complimentary at the same time. It's been a real pleasure. I think Charles and I work really well together. When I first joined Chambers, we did a couple of cases together and worked out very quickly that we got on incredibly well. So co-authoring a book was very easy in many respects. It was the first book I've ever co-authored with anyone. We've done a number of articles together. So it posed its own challenges, but Charles was incredibly encouraging, and it's been a wonderful learning experience for me to learn from him.
And in many cases, co-authoring means a bit of a book each, but I can see from the preface that's not how you went about it. So tell me a little bit about the sort of co-authoring where you didn't just divide it up.
No, so stylistically speaking, we wanted it to read with the same voice throughout, which I think is sensible, and it gives us a coherent sense throughout the text. I think it was also important for us both because it gave us an opportunity while we were writing it to look at matters of substance together, and there were certain areas where we actually disagreed, and it enabled us to come to lock horns and bat ideas around, which I think certainly deepened my understanding of the few areas where we did need to really thrash out what we thought was the right answer.
Yes, I mean we decided very early on when we first started talking about this not to split the book into different chapters with different authorships. There were two reasons for that. The first was that one sometimes gets the idea that you can see the joins between chapters, or you can see the overlaps between chapters. I'm not saying that is always the case, but it is a trap which I was particularly keen not to fall into. The second reason, which I suppose was the reason at the forefront of my mind, was that when this book was conceived of many, many years ago, I saw it as a book which cut across carriage, sales, letters of credit. And I saw it as having a sort of seamless structure going through the functions of a bill of lading, but not just looking at them under the telescope of one contract, but under all three. And I was fearful that if we did split chapters up, that initial idea of the very first edition of the book would gradually disappear. So I was keen that we shouldn't, and I think, you know, I hope it's worked. And I definitely think it worked in terms of batting things around and locking horns, which happened a fair amount, which made it a pleasant experience.
But I guess that brings up the other area, which is, again, you cut across various areas of the law in the book, and therefore it sort of fills a niche, which is sort of between the sales books and the carriage goods by sea books, and indeed the finance books. Can you explain that a bit more for people who haven't come across the way that these interact?
Yes, well, look, I mean, first of all, books and then people, books. The market in English law, at any rate, is richly endowed with excellent works on bills of lading, on carriage goods by sea, on international sale contracts, and on trade finance. In practice, one is very frequently faced with issues where you fall between the gaps of those books. So early on, I found that I had all three sort of sets of libraries open on my desk. This was pre-virtual, when books were books. But the actual bundle in front of me wasn't answered by what A, B, or C. Not because there was something wrong with A, B, or C, but because the gaps simply weren't filled in. The interconnections, what I like calling the interstices, weren't filled in. So that's books. Then people. When I was young and in short trousers and did a lot of training in commodity houses, it became very clear to me that many of the disputes which ended up on your desks or on my desks ended up on the desks of lawyers, because the execution department in a commodity house had not been involved with the trading desk at the time that contract was traded, or had not been involved with the freight desk at the time that was, or the finance desk. So while each of those desks, each of those offices in some commodity houses, of course, each of those floors with the large commodity houses were doing their best in their separate markets, in the freight market, in the wheat market, or whatever, when you fitted all the bits of the jigsaw together, there were gaps, there were contradictions, there were overlaps, there were issues of construction which didn't, you know, I didn't know that I'd chartered a vessel, says the trader. I didn't know that you were thinking of chartering a vessel which was over 10 years old. I just signed a contract, a confirmation slip, saying under 3 years old. So I wasn't to know. And it became very clear to me when I used to train a lot people within commodity houses, that if only A knew what B was doing and B knew what C was doing, then life would be simpler and there would be fewer disputes. Likewise with solicitors' firms. You sometimes went into solicitors' firms where the shipping hand knoweth not what the letter of credit hand doeth, or what the commodities hand was doing. And increasingly it became clear to me that the market needed something which joined the dots. And that, as you kindly put it, is the niche which this book has always tried to fill, and is now again trying to fill, although in a different way, because time has passed on. There have been many changes since then, and now, of course, it's to us with our own perspectives. But the central theme that we're trying to fit together a jigsaw, which otherwise seems bewilderingly complex. I like calling this field the Rubik's Cube of commercial law, because you have to move it around in order to find your way to a solution. Francis, does all that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. It was a striking feature of our early discussions that Charles and I remember sitting down with Charles and I said, "Oh, I've got this sort of funny diagram that I tend to draw out when I'm trying to make sense of cargo disputes. And I draw on the bottom, I draw on a horizontal line, I draw the sale contract. And then I have a little roof, which is the carriage contract." And Charles went, "Oh, yes, that's really great. Funny you say that. I've actually got the same thing, but I've added the house to the bottom of it, which is the finance
aspect.
The letters of credit." And I went, "Oh, that's funny." And ever since then, I've adopted Charles's expanded version of my sort of roof version and expanded it into a house. And the book, effectively, if you draw this house diagram, the book unpacks that house in all its many myriad nuances, and in a way that I think is very clear, very important, and in a way that's unsiloed. Charles rightly pointed out at the beginning that there are a number of books that deal with sale contracts, a number of books that deal with carriage contracts, there are a number of books that deal with letters of credit or documentary credits. There are few, if any, that deal with all three and the relationship between all three. And that's what this book does, hopefully very well, in a clear and digestible format. Hopefully useful not just to solicitors, but also to industry professionals practicing as Charles said, traders.
And I guess that was going to be my next question. What is the sort of target audience for the book?
Well, a real range, I think, both in terms of, anyone involved in commodities trade, be they solicitors, but also practitioners in commodities houses, but also banks. Increasingly, both Charles and I, but particularly I think Charles in recent years, have been instructed by not your normal shipping firms, but your bigger banking divisions of Magic Circle firms to advise on things like letters of credit and how they interrelate with bills of lading.
Well, and probably the finance as well is one of the biggest changes since your first edition, Charles, came out, is that there's an awful lot more finance involved in commodity trading now, not just in relation to the letter of credit part, but in relation to various different financing mechanisms. And the banks, it is really, really important that they understand the documents involved as well as the traders do.
Yes, the way I like putting it, the first edition came out many, many years ago, 3 decades ago, 30 years ago, and if I focus on the banks and the difference in the questions coming from banks and the instructions coming from banks, 30 years ago, a bank getting involved with this sort of area got involved with the documents. Full stop. There was never any lifting of the veil behind the documents. The only real interest was, do I pay, don't I pay? Do I waive, do I get my applicant customer to waive or not to waive? What do I advise? Is my beneficiary being difficult? Is he right? Am I exposing myself to liability under the letter of credit? So the questions were relatively simple. You looked at the bill of lading, you looked at the various fields of the LC, and you looked, and probably only in extremis, at the UCP, at the relevant version of the UCP. Nowadays, banks have exploded that. I mean, I'm not saying they're not interested in that. Of course, they are in your run-of-the-mill. But there's much more now which is not run-of-the-mill. When the banks actually have a substantive interest, going beyond a security interest, the security represented by the Bill of Lading, going beyond the paper document interest, where they actually have a real commercial interest on what is happening to the goods. And it's rarely on one transaction, but frequently in a financing arrangement which underlies a whole series of transactions or a whole period during which transactions, say for crude, are being sold and bought. So their interest is far more substantive. It's not only important for them to appreciate what a bill of lading looks like for it to be a good bill of lading, but what a bill of lading actually is for it to be a good bill of lading. So the perspective from the finance side, from the finance houses, one might almost call them, is very much deeper and very much more fundamental. But that's not the only change in the market one can see. I mean, I'm sure you'd be able to tell us about this yourself, Diane, but trading houses, the legal function in trading houses has changed beyond recognition. One way I like putting it is that what happened to P&I clubs 20, 30 years ago is now happening to claims departments within the large houses, by which I mean there are many, many more lawyers within trade houses, claims handlers. Many of them have been legally trained and want to be able not just to get their hands dirty, but get under the bonnet of a dispute in a really substantive way. And I suppose going back to Francis's point, who, you know, the audience, there is a whole new audience which didn't exist when the book started.
And the book is now written effectively by two practitioners, whereas when you started, Charles, you were an academic. As I read and turn the pages of the book, what difference do I now see because it's two practitioners that are writing it? Francis?
Yes. Francis, you go.
Well, I think stylistically, one of the things that we wanted to change was when practitioners read textbooks, they don't read it from start to finish. And I think in this latest edition, Charles and I have worked quite hard to make sure that from a practical perspective, the questions and answers to those questions are front and centre. So when you open up a chapter 7 or whichever it is, you're presented with the key questions and the answers early on. And then if there is historical nuance that is relevant or context that is relevant, that tends to go afterwards. So we've moved away from what might be a sort of traditional chronological look. So we haven't started in 1856 and worked forwards. We've said, what's the law now? What's the question that's going to be relevant to you? Here's the answer. And by the way, here's a bit of background. If you need to go into more detail because you've got a really complicated case and you need to go back to that case, or here's the historical background later. And I think hopefully.
So does that make it much easier for the in-house lawyer or the busy practitioner to just dip in and dip out, find what they need?
We very much hope so, because they should be able to find the answer in the first couple of paragraphs of a relevant section, rather than reading the sort of historical narrative and arriving at the answer at the end of the relevant section.
Yes, I mean, I'd just like to add two points to that. First of all, from time to time, and not just because I'm in love with the subject, but because, or with myself, but from time to time, I have need to look back at the first edition, which was 1990. And it is a different book. It is a completely different book. For all sorts of reasons, I was much younger then. I had less practical experience. I was an academic, as you rightly point out. So the first edition was very much more pedagogical than this one is. But even if you look at the second and third editions, every time they changed. And I'd like to think that as the editions went through different iterations, they did become more practical, because of course that coincidentally happened as I was moving away from being an academic over to the dark side, over to being a practitioner. Francis's arrival has given added oomph to that, in the sense that, again, I suppose, a hangover from my earlier life, I love asking questions. Francis loves giving answers. So you will find that headings in particular have gone from ending with a question mark with to not quite ending with an exclamation mark saying, isn't it obvious, you? isn't this the obvious answer? Not quite that, but they are very much more practical answers. Also, in terms of practitioner-friendly or user-friendly, Francis and I spent a lot of time this time round on the index. I'm a strong believer in the mantra that a book is only as good as its index, because I know from my own practice, I don't have time to look around. I want the book to tell me where to look. Mm. And the only way a book can tell you where to look
is by having
a first-rate index, which are more difficult to find, I'm afraid, thanks to computers, because structure in an index does take the input of real people.
Yeah. Rather than a word search.
Rather than a word Absolutely. Search, correctly.
The other thing, I suppose, is that you note, I think, that court decisions in this area are the tip of the iceberg. And I suppose one of the benefits of being a practitioner writing this book is that, you know, you have access to much more than that tip of the iceberg. As an academic, maybe you're looking mostly at the decided cases, but as practitioners, you're looking at the arbitrations that you're involved in, you're looking at the questions that come across your desk, and, you know, a lot of them feed into the sorts of material that you can see then are important, you know, in this area.
That has happened enormously with both of us. In my case, I can actually look at parts of the text and I know the arbitration case in which I sat as an arbitrator or acted as counsel. Of course, because it's arbitration, there are no names, because there can't be any names. Mm. And I'm sure, Francis, you found the same. Do you want to...
I mean, there's a very... I mean, right almost before we were about to press send... on the manuscript, and I had a case that involved questions of title passing, I think, and I went back to the book and I thought, and I had a look at the relevant section and I thought, hold on a second, I think we can, I've now dug into these cases in quite significant detail and I think we can word this slightly better, and so we made some last minute edits to a couple of paragraphs. So that was a very
After a good deal of horn locking.
After another good deal of horn locking over email this time, rather than.
And that was post proof. The publishers were fantastic.
So they're very accommodating. But that's another example of how practical experience on the ground, in a case in this instance in Dubai, resulted in material changes to the text itself.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, everyone, for listening. It was really good to have this platform in which Francis and I could speak about something we've been living with over the last few months. I should start by saying thank you very much, Diane, for making the time for this. I know you're very busy with your own arbitral practice, and that anything which interrupts does actually intervene into your daily schedule. So thank you very much indeed. And it was personally very pleasant for us to be in contact this time about the book. I can't finish without thanking Francis very much. I started off by saying that without finding a co-author, this edition would never have seen the light of day.
You were very honest about that at the beginning, Charles.
Yes, absolutely.
That without Francis, so there would be no fourth edition.
There would be no fourth edition. So I am very pleased, not only that Francis agreed to come aboard with a very pernickety main author, old author, or call it what you will. But it was fun being pernickety with Francis, and it was great to see that the book will in the future be in safe hands. We look forward to many other editions coming from the De Battista horny old Strickland stable at 36 Stone. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed, everyone, for listening in. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.